night, 7 to 3. The Blackhawks skate in Nashville tonight. Now the WGTD Tuesday forecast from the National Weather Service. Sunny, breezy, and mild for the morning. Then cloudy, breezy, and mild for the afternoon. A high 56. Right now, wind is from the southwest at 14. It's a sunny morning. 55 degrees in Racine. 54 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for the morning show comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Jack Andrea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. That familiar music is the overture to Handel's great masterwork, Messiah. And that is just one of two masterpieces that we're going to be talking about on today's morning show. I'm very happy to have with me in the studios Dr. James Kinchin, who is the director of choral activities at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And this weekend, he will be presiding over two performances of Handel's Messiah, and the following weekend presiding over a concert that is part of their series called Choral Treasures, in which singers from the University of Wisconsin Parkside will be collaborating with young singers, in this case the combined concert choir of Westosha Central High School, for a performance of Antonio Vivaldi's Gloria. So we are going to be talking about both of these tremendous works of music and playing a few excerpts from each and talking about the joys and challenges that are part of mounting performances of works of this stature. Dr. James Kinchin, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. It is such a pleasure to be here, as always.
And even in a busy week when you have all these big projects sort of staring you in the face, it does probably come as something of a pleasure to be able to just sit for a moment, catch your breath, and just talk about these things and not
Indeed.
Be worrying about the doing of them. But let's talk, first of all, about Handel's Messiah. And you have quite a connection with this work, and I know performances of Messiah, or at least portions of Messiah, that is a very rich tradition at Parkside that's been around for quite some time. Just remind us about sort of the length and breadth and scope of this Parkside tradition.
Well, we started doing this in 1993, and we have done it at three-year intervals since then. So for the past 24 years, every 3 years, we do a series of Messiah performances. The length of the series varies. Sometimes we've done as many as five in a series. This year, it's two. And one of the commitments that I made when I first decided to do Messiah, first sort of summoned the courage to take on that work, was to do it in its entirety. And obviously, you know that there are variants within the work that Handel himself did, but to do the whole thing, because so often it is excerpted, and people will do what they sometimes refer to as the Christmas section of Messiah. Well, during Handel's lifetime, it was never done during the Christmas season. It was always done at Lent. But nonetheless, we've been doing Messiah. And interestingly, as we think about it, we have been doing it in different venues in the region. Hmm. So, for example, I can think of three different places in Milwaukee where we have sung Messiah. We have sung it in Burlington and in Waterford. We have sung it in Kenosha City a couple of times in a couple of different places. We've done it in Racine. So we've sort of taken Messiah out and about with us. But starting in 2011, when we were so fortunate to get the RITA, what we call the RITA, which is the RITA Talent Pickin Regional Center for Arts and Humanities, and within the RITA, Francis Bedford Concert Hall, we have been just enthralled with the opportunities to come and perform Messiah and anything else we can sing in that beautiful acoustical space. But we've been doing it since 93, every 3 years, and doing the work in its entirety.
So now you are, you have at least for the most part kind of dispensed with that taking it on the road facet, and the performances now happen at Parkside.
Yeah, and this season we do that. A couple of cycles ago, we did one of the performances at the Cathedral in Milwaukee, which was a really exciting thing to do. But now, you know, we're real happy in this season to do it in Bedford Concert Hall. Hmm.
I remember with pleasure, I mean, on a couple of different occasions, being the bass for you. And I remember one of those years was a year where you were taking Messiah on the road. And and so we, you know, my recollection is that we did it maybe in five different locations.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Which was exciting. And I also remember within those five performances, variations from performance to performance in terms of, for instance, which soloist might sing a given aria, an aria that evidently Handel during his lifetime assigned to various voice types through the course of his career. And there are probably some conductors who wouldn't want to take on kind of the added stress on themselves of being in different locations and even varying certain specifics about the performances. But obviously that must give you a certain level of satisfaction to be willing to kind of take on that extra level of challenge in this.
Yeah, no, I like that very much, and remember with great pleasure myself those times when you were able to collaborate with us. But so, for example, one specific that comes to mind is the so-called Refiner's Fire aria. In modern Messiah performance tradition, that's always sung by the bass, but Handel didn't write that for the bass. He wrote the version that was most often performed by him in his lifetime was for alto, And there were some performances where he actually had a countertenor do that. And so you can imagine the kind of timbre that the countertenor would bring to that role, you know. And then he also, and that, for, you know, for just for reference, that alto version is in D minor. But he also wrote a G minor version of that for soprano, you know, which you don't hear very much at all. And, you know, we had the opportunity to do that on a few occasions, which was great. Another variation that that we did, the Rejoice Greatly, which is the touted coloratura aria in there that so many sopranos, you know, either sing well or wish they could sing well. well, Handel has a jig version of that, and it's not someone else's arrangement of it. It's Handel's own, and he used that on a certain occasion. I don't know the circumstances, but maybe it was with a soprano who had quite a lovely sound but was unable to really do justice to the 16th note melismas. I don't know. But anyway, and the jig is very charming. So we've done that as a variation as well.
I'm sure I've read someplace that through the course of Handel's life, not only was Messiah always done as some sort of charitable event from the very first time it was done, but also that, as far as we can tell, he never did it the same twice in his whole life. I mean, it was a work he was constantly transforming in subtle ways of one kind or another. But in other words, no two performances of Messiah during Handel's lifetime were ever done the same. Was that typical of him, or do you think that is indicative of some sort of special feelings he had for this work?
That's a good question, and now you have given me some impetus to go and do some research into that, because I think it would be good to know whether that would be the case with some of the other oratorios that he did, you know, with Samson or Esther, whatever, or some of the operas that he did, and I don't know, but we get the sense that perhaps he was more fluid with Messiah, and further, we get the sense that this kind of fluidity, as he made his way through successive performances of it, was less about artistic concerns and considerations, and more about making this piece singable by, and to use another word, which sounds a little crass, sellable. For the audience, with people that he had available to do it, and capitalizing on their strengths as soloists, and how he, with his genius, figured out that, you know, I've got a real strong alto for this, and I've got a real strong tenor for that, or this year not so much, and so he would do that. The other thing that's interesting is that we have said, and I'm certainly guilty of this, as I think just about everybody else is who does Messiah, we've settled on a a solo quartet to do it. Many times in Handel's life, he had more than four people singing the solos, you know. So sometimes there would be a couple of sopranos, even three sopranos, who would rotate between various arias, and perhaps there's something to be gained from that, and maybe that's sort of my next frontier.
Right. Well, that makes sense when you think, for instance, of just the soprano arias. Somebody who can sing the frantic 16th notes of Rejoice Greatly, also being able to sing the majestic I Know That My Redeemer Lives. I mean, it is rare to find a soprano who manages both of those with sort of equal assurance. And it's almost as though he didn't have one soprano in mind when he composed it. So let's talk for a moment about the challenges that are posed to the choir that sings this. What would be some of the aspects of this music that would make it an especially stiff challenge, especially for young singers?
Yeah, for young singers, and I would also add to that, for even adult singers, even community adult singers, who are not in the strictest sense singers, meaning trained singers and trained musicians. For starters, I guess maybe the obvious, there are a lot of notes there. I mean, you know, you got, I think, what, 21 choruses, and there are lots of notes to go around. And so just being able to master and surmount the technical challenge of singing all of those notes. Some of the choruses present challenges in terms of sustaining intensity at a slower tempo. Some of them present challenges in terms of executing melismatic passages. You know, you think, for example, of "For Unto Us a Child Is Born," where the first soprano lick starts out sort of in the middle of the range and then ends up, you know, at an A. And that's a pretty good challenge. Then I think also it's to do it musically, you know, which is sort of a level or two or three above. I can do this, you know. and then to consider out of all of the interpretive decisions that are there that are available to you, which ones represent a style that is, as far as we know and as far as we have been able to understand and discern, both from external historic information and from the internalities of the score, you know, what are those decisions that best reflect Handel and that best speak to that style of music at that time? And so for us, it's almost been like if you've got some painting, for example, that was done three or four centuries ago, and it's gotten two or three layers of whatever on it, you know, dust, dirt, or grime, or whatever, and you've got to clean that away so that you can try to see what the original was like. For those people who are listening to us who know Messiah, the "He Shall Feed His Flock," for example, in my estimation, based on what I understand about Baroque values, and style, is probably taken really slowly by us in a way that's much more appropriate to Romantic style, 19th century style, capital R. Than it is maybe to Baroque style. And once you strip that away and you begin experiencing that aria at a tempo that probably is more like what Handel would have intended, you go like, and then phrasings and those kinds of things, to have the singer then begin to share with you some of those understandings that you know, we will inflect in a certain way, you know, we'll group these notes together in a certain way. And those are challenges. And I think beyond the fact that you've got to have this edifice there first of rhythms and pitches and texts and so forth, that's just tremendously important and challenging, and something that you continue to pursue all the way through to the performance.
Why don't we listen to one of the choruses that you specifically mentioned by name as you were describing the challenges and delights of this score? Let's listen to a little bit of the chorus of "For Unto Us a Child Is Born," which, of course, hands off that wonderful melody to all four parts of the chorus, and it's certainly one of the high points of any Messiah performance. So here it is.
Is born. For unto us a child is born.
One of the great high points of Handel's Messiah, "For unto us a child is born." We are speaking right now with Dr. James Kinchin, who is director of choral activities at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. He will be conducting two performances of Handel's Messiah December 2nd and December 3rd. So 7 o'clock Saturday night and 3:30 Sunday afternoon at UW-Parkside in the Francis Bedford Concert Hall, a gorgeous place to experience music. And this will be Messiah in its entirety. I remember the first time I sang Messiah under you, and it was the entire Messiah, including certain choruses that quite often get cut, but you didn't cut anything at all. And of course, you hear that and think, oh, boy. And it was actually so much a revelation to me, and I think to a lot of people, that actually when you do the work in its entirety, in some amazing way, it doesn't feel longer. It almost feels shorter, because particularly for long stretches of it, maybe not without fail, but much of this work just has this amazing, miraculous flow from one piece to the other. And just by doing everything Handel intended to be done, it just creates this cohesive flow to it that that makes it just dash by, even though you are hearing a lot of music and actually quite a lengthy performance, but it doesn't feel like it in the moment at all.
No, I mean, you said it so well. It really hangs together so well as a work. I mean, you know, and surprise, surprise, Handel was a genius of a composer, but he also was one of the greatest dramatic minds, if you will, to compose music at that time. And you have to remember that in addition to all of the other wonderful things that he contributed to the repertoire, his orchestral things, his suites, his organ music, his anthems, and all of those things. That the heart of his creative output was doing works that would engage an audience from the stage. For the first part of his career, Italian opera, and then oratorio. So he knew how to attract the mind, the heart, the attention of the listener, and to keep that. And that's very much evident in the way that he puts Messiah together.
Yeah. And he certainly knows how to tell a story.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Absolutely. So this is such a treat. And I suppose one nice thing about doing it at the intervals that you do is that, although this also makes it challenging, but that many of your young musicians are coming to Messiah potentially for the first time.
Yes.
That, I suppose, stokes the sense of excitement.
Yes, it does. And I think it's so fortunate that we get a chance to have them experience it. And hopefully in the 3-year rotation, people get a chance to experience at least every now and then one reason or another, somebody kind of slips through that. But because I mean, it's one of those great works that everybody should, you know, should sing, if you have the opportunity to sing it or to be able to play it.
Absolutely. And of course, it's a great opportunity to sing it or play it in its entirety and to hear it, to experience it in its entirety. So again, this weekend, Saturday night, 7 p.m. and Sunday afternoon, 3:30 p.m., Handel's Messiah in its entirety at Francis Bedford Concert Hall on the campus of the University of Wisconsin-Parkside.
And may I add one thing? And this is a source of pride, and excuse me if I brag a little bit, but in Francis Bedford Concert Hall, when we do Messiah, at the harpsichord will be Francis Bedford. And she has played harpsichord on every single Messiah that we've done since 1993.
Wow.
And since 2011 has had what I can only imagine is the inestimable honor to play it in a hall that's named for her.
That's great.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's amazing. So I had to brag a little bit about
that. Oh, of course. Yeah. That's absolutely fantastic. And will we recognize any of the soloists?
I think that the people who have followed Messiah with us will recognize some of them because they are returning. We have at bass Brian Leeper. The tenor will be Scott Pullen. Alto is Allison Hull. The soprano is a new performer for us and somebody that we are real pleased to introduce to most of our listeners who I imagine will not have heard her, Ariana Douglas, who is Appleton-based singer, young singer.
Very good. So again, these performances of Messiah in its entirety this weekend, Saturday night and Sunday afternoon in beautiful Francis Bedford Hall. And then, as if that weren't enough excitement for you, the following weekend, so that's Sunday the 10th at 3:30 in the afternoon, yet another concert in this series called Choral Treasures, which mark opportunities for some of Parkside singers to collaborate with younger singers in the presentation of a great masterwork. First of all, what are some of the past masterworks that have been part of the Choral Treasures series?
Well, you know, we commenced experiencing Choral Treasures back in the fall of 2016. And so this will be the one that we are going to do on the 10th. It's going to be the fourth installment. Mm. The first one we did was the Nunez Garcia Requiem.
Oh, yeah.
Nunez Garcia being a Brazilian composer, Afro-Brazilian composer, who never set foot in Europe, but who composed in the quote-unquote classical style of Mozart and early Beethoven. And then we went from there to doing the Haydn Little Organ Mass in the spring of this year. Then earlier this fall, we did Mozart's Sparrow Mass, the wonderful little Missa Brevi setting, Kerschel 220. And our guests for each of those respectively were the Milwaukee High School of the Arts, the Horlick Chorale, and then the wonderful chorale from Indian Trail. And this time we get the opportunity to welcome a fine group of young singers, the West Osha Central Combined Concert Choir, under the direction of Rob Clark, who is, I am proud to say, I'm bragging again, my former student.
Right, yes, a proud Parkside graduate, a very fine young musician in his own right, and what an exciting collaboration this can be. Before we talk about Vivaldi's Gloria, let's hear just a little portion of this exciting piece, and let's listen to the exciting way, exuberant way, in which this work opens. This is a piece that probably, in some respects, is nearly the equal of Handel's Messiah in terms of its place in the choral repertoire. That being said, what prompted you to choose this to be part of this Choral Treasures series?
Well, it's a piece that I like, so I'm sort of giving away the fact that I get to choose, in collaboration with each of the high school directors that we do this with, that I get a chance to choose something that I like doing. And it is truly a masterwork. It's quite a bit shorter than Messiah. And what Vivaldi did was to choose one of the sections of the Mass, which normally would be a movement within the Mass, and to sort of break that down and expand it so that it became sort of like a cantata in form. And I like the fact that Vivaldi does such a great job of capturing different affects or different emotions and emotional states and characterizations within it. So the excerpt that we just played, which opens the Gloria, has these really wonderfully exultant leaps of the octave. You know, body, da-da-da-di, da-da-da. So it's almost in a sense the thing of praise sort of going up to heaven. And then the second movement is just totally in contrast. It's very peaceful. It's very sort of slow, and there is a lot of descending figuration in that work, and so it's almost like then peace coming down on humanity. And he does such a great job with that. The Domine Deus that the soprano sings is cast as a Siciliano, which it has this nice kind of rocking motion, and it almost suggests how one might rock a cradle as it talks about, you know, the Son of God who's the King of Heaven. And then the Domine Fili Unigenite, which has a lot of childlike robustness about it, you know, the energy of a child. And so it's really interesting how he goes from one to the other and does such a great job of really sort of sketching out what the emotion or what the expressive aspect of this particular section should be.
Yeah, there's a real expressive flamboyance almost about the work. I mean, he holds nothing back in terms of trying to take these various texts and really bring them to life. He does it so thrillingly. How difficult is this work to sing?
Since we were talking earlier about Messiah, it's not as difficult, not as many notes. So that's one thing that makes the preparation easier and the execution easier. Provides, in addition to the contrapuntal stuff. And so, for example, the Et in Terra that we were just talking about, even though it's slow, it's almost entirely counterpoint, you know. And then the final movement of the work, which is the Cum Sancto Spiritu, is also, you know, that's probably the most challenging of the work, in terms of how difficult it is. But then there's a lot of choral writing there. It's just beautiful, without necessarily being extravagant in terms of what it asks of a singer always. And that's something else. And that's a good question also, because that's something else that we try to look for when we choose the works with the directors to do in the Experiencing Choral Treasures series, to find something that's accessible to the students. Although perhaps if they were to do it themselves, they probably would not say we're going to do a Gloria, we're going to do a Sparrow Mass or whatever. But at the same time, it's quite doable for them.
So it's within their grasp in terms of being something they can sing, but might not otherwise sing unless they were able to do it in collaboration with a group, for instance, like your university chorale. So do you go down to Westosha at some point?
I will, yeah. Which is always fun for me. And my main purpose in doing that is, number one, just at a point when they've got the notes under control to share some of my artistic vision, to get us more accustomed to each other, and to know what that collaboration is going to bring in a more concrete way, because, you know, we're closer to the performance and I'm able to hear, you know, what they're doing and hear what the strengths are that they bring to the work. Yes.
When you actually perform, are they standing as a group and your singers as a group? Or are they intermingled on the risers?
We're intermingled, and that's a good question. I never thought about having us as discrete groups. I think of it as a true collaboration. Going back to when I was in high school, which I actually remember. if we had had that opportunity, I think it would have been a real thrill for me to be in the section along with the college guys.
Oh, right, of course, standing with them and combining your voices with theirs. And, absolutely. I think that's a tremendous source of excitement and probably great for your college students to have that experience of, in a sense, almost being mentors of a sort and standing side by side with these younger singers and together lifting up this tremendous masterwork by Mr. Vivaldi. So that performance is the 10th of December, 3:30 p.m., and I would assume back at Francis Bedford?
Yes, at Francis Bedford Concert Hall. And it will be with orchestra as well.
So your orchestra musicians have a very busy couple of weeks, nearly as busy as yours.
Well, yeah. But, of course, you know that culture, meaning of the orchestral musician, you want the opportunity to play.
Right.
And to have the opportunity to play, fine music and to do it in a setting that's credible and has integrity, that's all. That's what it's all about. That's
absolutely
what you're trained to do.
Sure. Yeah. I know that tickets will be available at the door, I would assume, but Francis Bedford is not that large a space. So if people want to secure their tickets ahead of time, what do they do?
They may, and they may call our box office, and I apologize that I don't remember that number right off the top of my head. But you may go on our website, uwp.edu, or call the box office. The number is accessible and find out about tickets. The box office does have hours where they're open for sale, and there are also card transactions, that are possible as well.
Very good. Dr. James Kinchin, Director of Choral Activities at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, presiding over two performances this weekend of Handel's Messiah and then the following weekend in their Choral Treasures series, Antonio Vivaldi's Gloria. And we'll end part one of today's program with a bit of that lovely second movement, the Et in Terra Pax, and on earth, peace, goodwill towards men. Dr. Kinchin, thank you so much for being here for this interesting conversation. Best wishes to you and all your musicians for these performances.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to come into this.
The time is 8:48. You're listening to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to finish out today's program by hearing an interview which I just recorded with MSNBC anchor Chris Matthews, who is also an author several times over, and his most recent book is titled Bobby Kennedy, A Raging Spirit. This is a book written very much from a personal perspective and is an insightful look at Bobby Kennedy, at who he was, and the forces that shaped him. Mr. Matthews, at the end of the very first part of the book, even before the prologue, you end with these intriguing words: "This is my story of Robert F. Kennedy." Can you explain those words, how this is your story of Robert F. Kennedy?
To do is get to the root of the man's soul. What was it that drove him throughout his life, the toughness of going after for the Kennedy family, fighting for the family, being a tough guy, even ruthless, and what drove him after that to be so focused on the minorities of the country, people in trouble? And I wanted to try to figure out, as I often do in these books, is to try to figure out the motives. Why is this guy this guy? What made him into that? And I go back to his older boy days and his love of his mother and his rejection by his father and how he had a fight in his family for attention and how he was the odd person out, and where Jack was the favored one after John Joe Jr. was the favored one because the old man wanted them to be president. And Bobby had to fight his way in that family, and he became tough, a tough enforcer for the old man. He became a jock at Harvard and won his letter up there despite having a broken leg. And only after his father faded away with his stroke and Jack died in the assassination did Bobby really go back to who he was in the beginning, a sweet young guy trying to do the right thing. So I think I tried to go deeper than most of the other books.
Right. But why is it – I mean, I like the way you say this, but why do you say this is my story of Robert F. Kennedy rather than this is the story of Robert F. Kennedy?
Well, because I think Arthur Schlesinger told one account of him, a kind of a historic account. And Evan Thomas told his account. And I wanted to tell the Irish Catholic story of growing up in a family very similar, although not, certainly not wealthy family, you know, with the whole things we focused on. We focused on the anti-communism. We focused on the bad guys in the world. It was a kind of a rooting for Notre Dame, being into football. It was very much eating grilled cheese on Friday. I mean, I wanted to try to tell the story from the Catholic, Irish Catholic inside. And that's what I think I accomplished better than, well, no one else ever tried to tell it that way.
Right. No, I think you do a great job. And you tell us in the prologue, the years of Bobby's public life were my times too. And so this is
Well, I watched it all growing up.
Of course.
And I was only 20 years younger than him. And so I watched his passage into public life. You know, I had a vague recollection of the rackets committee going after the mob. But I certainly understood he was the tough guy in the campaign in 60. And I certainly realized his role, his very aggressive role in fighting in the South against people like Ross Barnett in Mississippi and George Wallace and the Freedom Riders. I remember all of that, how he was hated in the South for being his brother's enforcer. So I wanted to figure him out. And I also, you know, I remember the 68 campaign. And, of course, as a college kid and a grad student, I was rooting for Gene McCarthy in the beginning. And then only in the end did I root for Bobby because and prayed for Bobby because he was the only one that could end the war. He was willing to go out and fight Johnson on that and then Humphrey. And that was the most emotional politics I've ever been through in my life, I think, the 68 campaign.
You say there are two main characters in Bobby's story, his brother John F. Kennedy, of course, and his father Joseph Kennedy, you've already mentioned. You tell us Bobby, of all the children, was the least like his father.
Yeah, that's what Jacqueline Kennedy said, and she meant it as a compliment. That he was a nicer guy. The old man was formidable, frightening. He took the wrong side in World War II. He was not sympathetic to Hitler, but he would tell the German ambassador von Dirksen, you know, you're not doing anything wrong over there with the Jewish people. Just you're making too big a deal about it. It was a PR problem, as Joe Kennedy saw it. I mean, that's pretty frightening. And he backed Chamberlain against Churchill. He didn't like Churchill. He didn't want Churchill's strong war position. And then the three sons come along, and Bobby included, have to sort of make up for the old man. So they all, Joe gets killed in the war with this frightening mission. He took over occupied France. Jack was disappeared for a week. They thought he was gone. Bobby tried, you know, he gave up his ROTC, went in the Navy as a swabby because he just wanted to get into the action at the end of the war. These kids were real patriots, whatever you think of their politics later on. The Kennedy boys were just gung-ho Americans.
Hmm. One of the interesting things about your book is the contrasts you draw between Bobby Kennedy and his brother John F. Kennedy. And you'd say at one point, Jack had the charm, Bobby had the conscience. And you tell us also that they were not particularly close as brothers until 1952. It was politics that ultimately brought them together.
That's right. Their sister Eunice said that she said it was all nonsense, that these guys were two peas in a pod, that they were natural buddies. I mean, in the beginning, Jack called, when Bobby came back from the Navy to help him in his 46 campaign, he said, he called him Black Robert. And he said, get him out of here. Send him off to some wards like the Italian wards they weren't going to do too well in, just to get him away from people, because Jack thought that he would be a downer, a Debbie Downer in the ranks, and would kill the morale. Because Bobby hadn't really grown up yet. It wasn't until after he'd played football, become a jock at Harvard, and developed some sort of personality, that he became this sort of strong character amazing evolution from 46 to 52, to the point where Jack let him run his campaign, and Jack said, "Bobby, you're going to save my campaign and get me elected to the Senate." And afterwards, Jack said, "Bobby was hated in Massachusetts. Everybody's mad at him, but he ran the best organization in the history of the state." Hmm. Bobby was a take charge guy by 52, but in 46 he was kind of a geek. He was just uncool totally to have around you. I wrote about this for the Boston Globe. I just think football. I know football's been in. You know, and people say it hurts your head and your brain and everything these days. That's all true. But it certainly made a man out of Bobby. Certainly did.
One thing you also say is you want to really disavow us of the notion, and I've seen it in several different books, that there was one Bobby Kennedy until his brother was assassinated, and then there was a more compassionate Bobby Kennedy after that. And you really want us to let go of that simplification of who Bobby Kennedy was. He was always the person that we remember from his later years, albeit maybe sometimes that compassion was veiled by other qualities.
That's the way I wrote the book. You just had it, Greg. That's Bobby back in the there's lots of evidence of him looking at his friends were African American kids, even at Iannisport. He had empathy for people that didn't have the breaks. When Father Feeney, Leonard Feeney in Boston, came out with the philosophy of no salvation outside the church, he sort of led the fight against him, saying you can't tell Jewish people and Protestants they're going to hell. And his mother thought he'd get excommunicated. It turns out the priest was excommunicated for that philosophy. Mm. And so he wanted Ralph Bunche, the great Nobel laureate, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, an African-American guy. He wanted him to speak at UVA when he was in law school, and all the white Southern kids were scared to death to bring him in because their political careers would be hurt back then. Of course, this is back during the days of Jim Crow. And he fought with the college president, got him to say, no, we're bringing in Ralph Bunche to speak. And not only that, but he had Ralph Bunche stay with him that night, and the people were throwing rocks at their windows, and they consider that still the safest place in town for him. So Bobby showed evidence a number of places with his high school classmate. He kept talking about, why can't we help the poor people? And they really, he was an outsider. And, of course, like a lot of people, he adjusted to reality around him, and he became a tough guy. But I do believe that he became more himself. Not that he changed, but became more Bobby at the end and became the generous guy he was as a kid. His old man would make fun of him for being generous. Some friend of the family, Lem Billings, said to the old man, you know, isn't it great how generous Bobby is? And Joe Kennedy Sr. said, I don't know where he got that from. You know, he was contemptuous of Bobby's sweetness, of Bobby's goodness. Mm.
A critic called your book a hopeful parable for our time, for our ugly times. Do you like that description? Did you want that book to be this, a hopeful parable?
Yeah, I do. I think that the scenes at the, on the back of the book, I really want the back of the book, that dirt poor white family, little white family, husband, one son, a wife, standing at the railroad tracks as his body goes by in June of 68, they're saluting him. These people are dirt poor. They got nothing. And yet, obviously, the guy had served in the military had a crisp salute. It's an affectionate patriotism that Bobby aroused. It was something that the Democratic Party has sort of lost. They're a little too aloof now and then. They don't connect with working people as well as Bobby could. And I think they need to connect with working white people as well as minorities in a way that he could. And he would like drive through a town with Richard Hatcher, the first black mayor of Gary, Indiana, on one side of him in the convertible, and Tony Zale, the great middleweight white boxer, on the other side of him to show, hey, look, I'm with everybody here. Let's get together. And as he said after King was killed that night, he said, we have to make an effort.
That was Chris Matthews, the author of Bobby Kennedy, A Raging Spirit, published by Simon & Schuster. Tomorrow on the morning show, I'll be speaking with Lisa Kronetsky, who is from the theater faculty at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, talking about their production of Angels in America, Millennium Approaches, which is going to be opening this weekend at Parkside. On Thursday, I speak with a faculty colleague of mine from Carthage, Dr. Peter Dene, who is the coordinator of Carthage's Christmas Festival, which is this weekend. With him on Thursday, I'm happy to say, is composer Jocelyn Hagen. She was commissioned by Carthage to write a special work that will serve as the finale for the Christmas Festival this year,